You are Locked On AFL, your daily AFL podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome to Locked On AFL. I'm your host, Kane Pittman.
Particularly with a pathetic effort from Pitt. I mean, it was the most disgraceful display I've ever seen from a big film. And that's pretty hard on an individual, but he's going to have to live with that.
And alongside me, as he is every day, Josh Lloyd.
Lloyd is Lloyd. Lloyd to Lloyd. 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 Lloyd.
Kane, I am here. I don't have Mark Williams here as my character witness, but I am here ready to go, ready to record the show. And of course, we did have some tribunal news last night with Dylan Scheel and his tribunal challenge not being successful, much like Hayden Crozier the week before, and his two-week ban is upheld. Ben Long goes for 3 weeks for that bump. What did you make of the whole shenanigans, I guess, around the Scheel suspension, the tribunal? Why do we need character references? I know that's happened plenty of times in the past. Nah, mate, he's a good bloke. Nah, that's fine. Still cracked him in the head with a bump. What's the point of it?
I'm not really sure. I thought the whole Scheel defense and the case in general was kind of crazy. I mean, this went on for a long time to get to the result of 2 weeks anyway. I thought the suspension was fair in the end. I mean, he gets 2 weeks. The big problem for mine was, as we spoke about yesterday on yesterday's podcast, was the guys that didn't get suspended. Gary Rowan, for instance, is a guy that probably should have got 2 weeks as well. But it's really difficult for me to even pull an example with the Scheel and Trent Cotchin one from 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it was now as well. Those ones were a little bit different. Cotchin had his hands on the footy. Scheel went past the footy, laid the bump. Difficult to compare those two as well, even though obviously it's the same person involved here on the other end of the other foot.
It's also years ago, though. Like, our opinions change and our protection changes as well.
They do. And in the end, as long as the case went for multiple hours, but it's the right result, I believe. And same for Ben Long. 3 weeks. Interesting evidence that they went with. I was watching on the couch. I think it was on the couch on Monday night, and they were showing some other examples of that's the technique that Ben Long goes for, and I certainly would agree with that when I look at the footage, but at the same time, it was a pretty aggressive bump, and if the league is serious about it and they actually want to set an example for protecting guys' head, it had to be multiple weeks. There's no way you could come out and reduce that. It didn't make a lot of sense.
Well, you know, at the risk of drawing the ire, and I don't think these people necessarily listen to this podcast, but we're turning the game into netball. Like, you can go in there and block a player out without crunching his head with the back of your hip. Like, and that's what Long was trying. I don't think he was going in there to deliberately hurt him. He was going in there to clear some space. And I think you could see that by the way he sort of turned his body. And I could see that. But to clear some space or block somebody out, you don't have to put the bloke in the next week. You can just get in his way. All right. And you can do that in very, very different ways to that. And it has a similar effect. A shepherd where the guy's got the ball, you don't need to absolutely destroy the guy. You just have to get in his way. And that's all that requires, just create that little bit of space. So there was a little bit of intent there to cause damage from Long, despite the fact that that's how he goes into contest. And three weeks is fine. And I think it was interesting that I believe St Kilda went into the tribunal and said he probably needs three. And the tribunal said, yep, probably needs three. And they went, cool, 3 weeks. So that's pretty interesting. So St Kilda obviously saw the flaw in it, in what he was doing there. They didn't go in with character witnesses and bring in, who are they going to bring in? The plugger's going to come in. He's a good guy. I would have done much worse. Like, what could they do? So they just went, 3 weeks sounds good to us. 3 weeks sounds good to you. Cool, shake on it. Let's elbow tap and we're out of here. But that's the tribunal results. Stewie Jew, Gold Coast Suns, we've talked about them so much. I didn't expect us to be talking as much Gold Coast Suns when we started this podcast. I thought, one of the things I had when starting this podcast, all right, got to make sure we cover all teams, got to be pretty even. Jesus, the Suns, man. Like, how are we going to do this? That was what I was thinking in my head. But they're really, really fun. And Stewie Jew gets a well-deserved two-year contract extension.
Yeah, well, remember, also in round one against Port Adelaide, they were awful. Now, Port's form is obviously held up, and they sit on top of the ladder, but the Suns didn't look great. And at that point, I think they were riding an 18 or 19-game losing streak. So, yeah, not a lot to talk about, but Stewie Jew deserves this. I felt bad for him last year watching those Suns teams lose. Clearly he was feeling the pressure. We've seen a bit of a merry-go-round when it comes to the Suns' coaching position, but another 2 years, he deserves that. The one thing I will say is that the expectations have to be tempered a little bit, because this is a Suns team that, and I've said this even when they were winning, I said, listen, they've won games early in the season before and then they've really dropped off. So they are young. We talk about the young talent they have. Now they're going to spend a fair bit of time on the road here the next couple of weeks, although they might benefit from the situation in New South Wales and Victoria and find themselves back at Metricon Stadium with regularity. But the Suns, look, listen, they got off to a hot start, and in some circles, people were talking about finals. I don't think that's going to be the case for them this year, but it's about watching the young guys get consistency. And let's be honest, I watched the Suns on the weekend. They lost the game, and it was bloody exciting because the young talent is good to watch. That hasn't always been the case with them.
I know you love it when I have breaking news on as we're recording the show, but this isn't 100% confirmed. But Jared Waitley is saying, this is the tweet from Jared. He said, I'm being told from a well-placed source that all Victorian clubs were told this morning that they will be based in Queensland for the remainder of the home and away season. So that looks like what's happening. We've got some outbreaks going in New South Wales. It looks like New South Wales hubs are going to be over as well. And basically, the entire AFL is going to be split between Queensland, Western Australia, and maybe South Australia. It happens a little bit later as well. So that's something that's just come through now.
Yeah, I mean, things are going to get really complicated. We spoke about the fact that they would look to maybe get teams back to Victoria, but with quarantine, with the situation down here, it just makes things too complicated. So I'm not all that surprised by that. I think the next thing that these states will be looking to do, or the teams will be looking to do, is saying, okay, can we get some family up there? Because we know, we've spoken about it. West Coast went through it. Fremantle have gone through it. Port Adelaide, these teams have been in the hubs. This is looking like months and months and months for the Victorian team. So there's no doubt. I mean, they're going to want to see whether it's kids, wife, partner, whoever it may be. They'll probably arrange something there. But I think it's the smart thing to do. If they want to keep the season running, the only other advice I have is Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia, please just lock your borders. Do not let anyone from Victoria or New South Wales in your state. It's not worth it, because living in Victoria, Josh, you know more than me. I'm in Geelong at the moment.
Oh, yeah, we're filthy down here.
Yeah, listen, but I wouldn't be letting us in either.
No, I wouldn't either.
You want to be keeping whatever situation you've got over there, and you're living some sort of normal life. Keep that rolling, however you can do that.
Yeah, let's reassess that in September or October. But for now, I'm not going anywhere. I'd love to be up in the Queensland sun during these 4 months off that I've done nothing. I'd love to be up there, soaking it in and going about my life. But yeah, there's no point in risking that. And this looks like they are going to be bringing up a whole bunch of more staff, more of the players that were left behind look like they're going to be going up to Queensland as well. Partners and families headed up there as well. That's what they're trying to negotiate at the moment. So that is some breaking news, relative breaking news, that looks like it's going to be going on all season. And that is really, when you think about it, not a surprise. The other thing that's not a surprise is the AFL not deciding where they're going to hold the grand final. They don't need to. Who knows what the hell's... I don't know what's going to happen in the next 20 minutes, next day, next week, let alone what's going to happen at the end of this season, if there is an end of the season. So I don't think there's anything that should be like, oh, the AFL doesn't decide. Cool. They don't need to decide. There's absolutely no reason to make any decision on that whatsoever. But now let's get on to a fun part of the pot. Well, not that this isn't fun, because it's always fun talking to you, Kane, but let's talk mailbag, because you blokes, listen to this, have been sending in the questions. Where are we starting?
Well, Russ Clark hit me up on Twitter now.
Rusty.
I'm not a soccer fan.
Neither am I, really.
So I actually don't know, and I purposely didn't look this up because I thought you might have more info than me, but he's asked this a couple of times, so we have to get to it right off the bat. Is Marcus Bontempelli just Harry Kane in disguise? Maybe. I don't know, though, and I can't really answer that. Maybe I should have been a good host and Googled that, but I didn't. But let me give you another comparison that I've always stuck with that I haven't had too many people agree with me. But Josh, you're a basketball man, so I know you'll be able to give me an answer on this one. Tom Hawkins and Kyle Korver. Maybe you need to put their heads next to each other, but it's one I've always thought they look similar.
No, I've got I can say that one. There is a definite crossover, especially with the way Hawkins has got his hair cracking at the moment. That is a definite crossover. I don't know if he's talking about Harry Kane and Bontempelli looking the same. I don't see that. I don't know if anyone else sees that. I know what Harry Kane looks like, and now I've actually brought the picture up just so I can, hey, am I actually sure what he looks like? I don't see that. Is this some sort of a dig at the way that Harry Kane plays or Bontempelli's form in the last 2 weeks? I'm not sure either. So, Rusty, a bit of clarification on that one, because I don't think it's a lookalike. I reckon you might need to reassess that.
So Draftman, and I was actually going to jump in and ask you this question a little bit earlier. We've got a couple of questions here from Draftman, but the first one, relevant to what we were just talking about with Dylan Scheel, Ben Long as well. He asked about the current Brownlow rules where you're suspended. So Dylan Scheel, now out of the Brownlow race, he's a guy that certainly was in with a chance. I mean, he's had a fantastic start to the season, a couple of best on ground efforts for the Bombers. If you're suspended, it's 2020. Do we really need to cancel these guys out of the running for the Brownlow medal?
I was thinking about this last night, actually. Yeah, not even because I don't think Dylan Scheel was going to win the Brownlow. I know it's tradition, and I know it's fairest and best, and it's something that we do, and other sports don't necessarily do it. But why? I get it. But if you get suspended games, then you lose the opportunity to get votes. So I think that's punishment enough. And if you can win it while still missing games and being, I don't know if we necessarily need the fairest part in there. We are not, this is not the 80s where, you know, pluggers, caving blokes, faces in every second week. And we're getting Lee Matthews King hitting Neville Bruns in the center square or dippers out there. Yeah, you know, Greg Williams is kidney punching guys. These are all guys who have won Brownlows almost, except for Lee. But, you know, they had to stay clean for that one season. This is not what's happening in the AFL. It's not this, you know, big bunch of snipers out there, non-Toby Green division who are out there, you know, just whacking guys left, right, and center. So I tradition, fine. Modern progress or where we sit, what's the point of it?
No, I agree. And you know what? The easy thing to look back at, and I say, well, imagine how many things were missed as well. Look at the camera angles now. You literally can't get away with anything. Would you sit here and say if Zach Merritt, let me just go on the record to say I don't think Zach Merritt's going to win the Brownlow, but if Zach Merritt had the most votes in the Brownlow, are you seriously going to sit there and feel comfortable saying you can't win the Brownlow medal because of that that little, well, I was going to say tummy tap, but kidney tap, rib tap, whatever you want to call it,
rib
that he gave, yeah, that he gave Silvani? You kidding me? Come on, it's ridiculous. And the other thing is, hey, if you miss two games and you still poll the most votes, good for you. There might be a couple of players, Corey McKernan in particular, that will say, hang on. If we're doing this.
I reckon Chris Grant might have a discussion about that too.
Exactly. So there might be some old players, the older players that are saying, hey, come on, where's my medal? But I agree, scrap it. You get suspended, you can still win the Brownlow. It's fine. The second question from Draftman, I think this one's pretty simple. He says, why do players often get taken off right after they kick a goal? It's the easiest place to get a rotation in, Josh. We know that. It's all about defensive structures in this game. Players would get crucified if they come off at a time that leaves the defense vulnerable and a team ends up slingshotting their way down the field to kick a goal. We know how hard goals are to come by this season. It's purely rotation-based. And that's why now, this was never the case, but that's why now you see it's such a big deal when players are, they're like, oh, Paddy Dangerfield, he's been on the bench for 7 minutes. They can't get him on because the players aren't willing to break that structure and run off in the run of play because it can prove too costly. So that's why we see it. But you, I mean, I know you played footy. I never would have won. I didn't kick that many goals, but I never would have wanted to come to the bench after I kick one. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, I didn't kick that many. I didn't kick that many either. But when I was playing footy, we weren't in the big rotations. It was like we make changes at quarter time, and unless someone gets hurt during the quarter, that's how we tended to run it. When I was playing, but I don't think it's maybe not as prevalent now. It used to be like kick a goal and you come straight off. Now it doesn't feel like that happens every time. But the reason is it's just this is a key time for you to get that rest. Like you, it's a key trigger that you don't need someone to come out and tell you kick a goal, come off, have a rest, and then get the next message and then come back on straight away. It's just an easy time rather than having to get the runner to come out and tell you. And this is when the runner was allowed on the field the whole time. That's what it was. It was just, well, this is when we don't need to actually get that rotation. You know, when you kick one, just come and have a spell, and that's your time off rather than having someone to come out and try and find that right moment in play. So that's why that would happen. It doesn't seem to happen quite as much anymore, but that's why, and the stoppage in play, as you mentioned. Nath Freelink says, why do you think teams are happy to just kick it long inside 50 to a pack of 10 or more players? I know it's an old cliche, just put it at the top of the square, but this kick is maybe marked or crumbed once or twice a game, and teams are wasting a lot of inside 50s. And I tend to agree with that, is that when everybody knows that it's going to the top of the square, everybody congregates there, and we're not seeing, it's very hard to take a pack mark when 10 blokes are going up in that pack. The crumbing is harder to do because there are a lot of guys around there. And I'd say majority of the time, you know, over 50% of the time, which is what majority means for those of you who don't have a dictionary handy, the opposition gets it and it's a rebound 50.
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways I look at this. And yesterday we were talking about GWS, the team that we're asking, why aren't they getting the ball in the 50? Why aren't they looking to attack? Why aren't they moving the ball forward? Plenty of disposals. The possession count is high. The inside 50s is low. But this is all about the tempo of the game. And if you can get the ball in quickly, then you give yourself the best opportunity to score. I think we're seeing a lot of teams bomb it to the top of the square because they're too slow. And they chip the ball sideways. They go from side to side. And by that point, I don't know what teams want. We spoke about Hardwick and Longmire. I don't know what Hardwick wants Longmire to do. If a team's chipping the ball around the 50, does he want that opposition coach to say, all right, yeah, we'll just let you chip it around until you find a nice little bit of space there where someone can lead up and take the mark? No. If you're slow, the opposition is going to say, okay, how can we stop you from scoring? We're going to get numbers back into the 50. I mean, it just makes sense. And that's when footy becomes pretty mundane and it does become tough to score, and it becomes this territorial game where if you keep the ball in your forward half, then it's almost like I don't know what the comparison would be. NFL, where it becomes a territory game, and it's like, well, we're rolling 36 players up and down the field. That's what it turns into. So the only way around that is quick ball movement, to take risks, to be attacking. And the teams that are doing that the best are the teams that are scoring. So when they kick it to the top of the square, I agree, it's a pretty low percentage kick these days because of the congestion in the forward 50. But if you're slow, there's no other option. There's nowhere else to kick the ball. So you're forced to say, well, you know, either we get a big pack mark here and we kick a goal, that's a great result. Worst result, we create a stoppage, and that's what we'll settle for.
The other thing is I think it's fine in a emergency situation. You got it. You can't see another option. You're about to get pinged, and you got to boot it up there. As a routine decision to kick it there, it's not a great idea. The other thing is when if you're streaming in, you've got the ball in the pockets or in the flanks, and that centering ball to the top of the square. It's a very different scenario because most of the time when you're running that hard in those pockets and got the ball free like that, that's because, as you mentioned, that the ball has been moving quickly and there are going to be blokes just sitting there on their own. It's not a squaring kick to a pack of 10, 12, 15 blokes there. We find those open players because you've moved it and created that panic and scramble from the defense. But as a emergency, oh God, I am in massive trouble. I'm about to get pinged. I've just got to get it on my boot. It's the place to go to because something can happen. It doesn't most of the time. But as a strategy, yeah, moving the ball quickly, finding the guys on the leads and that's just one thing. If you're at a game live, which, hey, I don't know when I'm going to do that again, but a great way to tell if teams are on, like, are players moving? Like, when they don't have the ball, like, how much are they moving? Because the more you move, I have no correlation to this. This is just from years and years of watching. The more players are moving without the ball, the more successful or more on they seem to be.
Yeah, again, it comes down to the pace of play. If you're moving the ball slowly, the only way that you're going to get a score outside of someone bombing one from 60 and kicking it over the crowd of players or pinpointing a guy in the lead, you need a breakdown from the back line, from the opposition back line. You need someone to fall asleep and create a little bit of a vacuum for a guy to lead into. So that's basically why it happens. But there's no doubt when it's just a long bomb into a pack of 15 players, that's when footy can be a little bit tough to watch at the moment. Hey, we had a question that was late on the Twitter. I just want to quickly throw it at you so you're not prepared for this one. So this is completely my fault here. But Dean Vasich, he sent in a few questions over the weeks. He mentioned you. He says, we know your thoughts on hitouts. Everyone that listens to this podcast knows your thoughts on hitouts. But he asked about clearances. He feels like there's a similar correlation with clearances. Perhaps the stat in a vacuum, when you just look at it, is not as important as it may seem.
This is a question without notice. I didn't see this on the tweet, but this does remind me now. I'm trying to find where yes, there it is. I was on Stats Insider 2 days ago, and I'll link it in the notes. There's a great, great article written by Joshy Elliott. Shout out to you, Josh, talking about the results of clearances and how important they actually are, and showing that clearance differential and, you know, margin or points scored or winning isn't necessarily correlated. But what they did find from this article is that preventing scores from clearances, so your ability to stop team scoring from clearances, is highly correlated to winning. So it's in terms of stoppage points per clearance from 2018 onwards, the top teams, over that 18 to 20 period, we're talking Richmond, West Coast, it's probably the two top teams. And Richmond's in the middle of the pack there, West Coast is fifth, GWS is on top, Brisbane's second, and they had two good years but one poor year. But when you look at the teams stopping points. West Coast 1, Collingwood 2, GWS 3, Richmond 4. So they're the teams that stop scoring from stoppages. At the bottom of that list, Carlton, Gold Coast, St Kilda, North Melbourne. So that is what they found. And the correlation graph on that is really, really sharply correlated to winning versus stopping points from clearances versus winning those clearances yourself. So it's not just winning the clearances. It's about scoring from them. But more importantly, it's about stopping teams scoring from those clearances.
If I look at the top five teams for clearances this season so far, Port Adelaide, number one, Geelong, number three, Brisbane, number five. So it's still important. I mean, the top three teams in the league are in the top five for clearances across the AFL. North Melbourne, second. Now, that's where it becomes interesting because you look at the season that Todd Goldstein is having. Fantastic. He's wound back the clock. He's been unbelievable. But North Melbourne, we know, haven't been able to kick scores. So that's where that article, as you said, comes to it. And just as a note, I remember this off the top of the head. They were talking about it on the Foxtel broadcast, on the Fox Footy broadcast before the game. Brisbane and Geelong played last Thursday night. Brisbane coming into that game was the number one team at scoring from centre clearances. So as you, when you talk about stopping teams, Geelong were able to do that. They were able to stem the flow, particularly in that second quarter, and it resulted in a win. And the tables turned, and you had a guy like Paddy Dangerfield coming out of the mill. So no doubt, that's a good article. I got to check that one out myself for sure. Next question.
One more thing. One more thing on that, because we talked about it a couple of times in today's show about pace, and we're well aware of pace neutral stats in the NBA per possession numbers. Mm-hmm. There needs to be something like that in the AFL, because if we talk about North Melbourne winning this many clearances, how many clearances are actually in their games that they're playing though? Like teams that play different styles of game, faster games, slower games. Slower games in general tend to be more stoppages, but then there's also more center clearances in high scoring games. So how does this all work? Because we can say, well, that's great. They average 34 a game, and Richmond averages 26 a game. But is that because of Richmond just being this low possession, as move it on at all costs sort of style? I think we've got to look at it more on a pace basis, and I think the same thing goes for possessions as well. I remember, I'm not smart enough to do this, but back in the day when Gary Ablett was racking up 40 a game, even for Gold Coast, but more back in his first Geelong stint, and that's great, but Geelong's averaging like 450 disposals a game, where other teams are at 360. So while he's getting a ton of these disposals, and look how far ahead he is everyone else, the whole team, and when you play against Geelong, therefore, a lot of these numbers go up and tackle numbers go up. There needs to be some sort of normalization of how this works in terms of percentage of stoppages or pace of game. And I think that's where the next level goes. And there's probably people already doing it that I don't know about, but I think it's something to bear in mind as well.
All right. Next question comes from a friend of mine, Jung. You've heard me speak about him a little bit, Carlton fan, which is unfortunate. But he asked a pretty interesting question. If you're making a Moneyball side based on only stats and efficiency, who would be the number one pick? So, I mean, I guess whether this is from a fantasy perspective, whether this is a guy that you're looking to maintain, so age comes into factor, I'm not sure. But how did you look at this question, and who are you rolling with? I've got a couple of guys here, so I'm cheating a little bit. What are you thinking?
Well, the number one thing that I thought about here is that the term Moneyball gets thrown around a lot without actually being used correctly. And what Moneyball is looking at, it's trying to find players who are undervalued and underpaid based on their production. It's getting value out of them, and it gets thrown around in the mainstream footy media all the time. John Ralph has a Moneyball column. It's like, well, Moneyball, should teams go after Jeremy McGovern? Like, yes, like he's really good. We all know that. Like, we know how good of a defender he is. We know this. Moneyball is Lachie Neal should be high on people's targets, and they should pay him a lot of money. Like, no shit. Like, that's not what Moneyball's about. It's about finding these guys. And I think St Kilda, to a degree, he did it a little bit with Dan Butler this season. They're trying to find that guy who can just provide the value at a cheap price, a cheap acquisition. So that's sort of where I started approaching it for. But he's talking about looking at efficiency here and looking at guys that, you might not necessarily look at as the star type players, but I mentioned this guy last week. Callum Wilkie is going at 91% disposals. That is, it's not a huge amount of possessions, but that is over six games, 91% is it's a pretty efficient sort of number. And this is a goal. Hey, Jordan Rofford's gone at 91 as well, but he's not a guy that's you're spotting guys up as much as Wilkie is. So I think that's the sort of thing that you really should be taking a look at, is these players who are getting the ball a decent amount and able to hit targets, if that's the way we're looking at. And again, not really a highly regarded name at this point. He's 24 years of age. He's only played 28 games. But yeah, he was a rookie pick as well. But that's the sort of thing that a guy that can use it that way, who is undervalued, and you get at that cheaper price. That's the sort of way I look. I wouldn't say be my number one pick, because yeah, a guy that comes in on a rookie contract and is the number one pick in the league, Matt Rowell, would be that. If you want value for money, like, that's where you're looking. But looking for those undervalued type guys, Callum Wilkie stood out to me.
Yeah, so if I had to guess what Jürg was saying, because the reason why he said stats and efficiency, I believe, in relation to Moneyball, is because, you know, everyone that's seen the movie, we know that they went off stats, or the A's. I'm an A's fan, by the way. I love the A's. The A's went off stats that not a lot of other teams were looking at. Now, I'm sure everyone in 2020 is certainly taking note of efficiency, but I think the point would be, as you sort of pointed to, for a number one pick, which is what the question says, you're not going to take Callum Wilkie. So that's why it's a little bit confusing. But and I went a different path of this. I went down more prominent players than you certainly did, because I'm not sure what you do. Would you say in your draft, okay, take out the top 100 players? Like, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you go about that. But as far as efficiency goes, I went for a guy that he's 28 years old, so he's a little bit older. And you might say, you know, is this guy going to be the number one pick in a fantasy draft? Maybe not. But if I was trying to build a side, I feel like almost the most important position on the ground in 2020 is that halfback intercept mark player, beautiful kick, sets up the attack. We spoke about guys being able to take risks from the back line. So I went with the guy from GWS. They're not playing attacking football. Maybe he needs to take the initiative a little bit more. I went with Nick Haynes. He's 28 years old, but he's number one in the league for intercept marks. Number two among defenders for contested marks. Fourth in the league for rebound 50s, 20th in total meters gained on the season at 355 per game. He's averaging, he runs at 75% disposal efficiency. Nick Haynes is a gun, an absolute gun. You see it every week. And he not only takes the uncontested intercept marks, but he takes the contested marks. He flies over the packs. He's a star. And maybe when you think about the number one pick that you'll go for in the league, he is maybe not number one, but for me, that's the type of player I'm looking at.
Yeah, that's another a great one to look at. I think another way you could look at it is even someone like a Harris Andrews, someone that you just go, well, yeah. He's my last line guy. He's leads the league in one percenters. He takes intercept marks. He shuts down opposing forwards. Put him back there, and then my defense just builds completely around that. And generally, you want someone to win the ball, but there are a lot of players who can win the ball. There's very few players who can do what he does. And that's part of Moneyball as well, is finding that value. What's the most replaceable and irreplaceable type of player, or player type, or whatever you want to phrase it? Like, if I get Andrews, if I miss out on Andrews, then I have to go, well, then, you know, do I need Stephen May to fill that role for me later on? Like, what's the drop-off between him or versus Lachie Neal, and then getting Bontempelli or Fife or Dangerfield or Selwood or up-and-coming guys like Petrarca? What's the drop-off there? And that's part of what Moneyball is about as well, because you might not get the number one midfielder, but if you get the number six guy, it's better than getting the number six key defender.
Yeah, Jürg, text me. Text me what your answer is so we can get an idea of what you were thinking. So I'm sure I'll talk to him later, but I'd be interested to know what he's thinking. He's pretty plugged into the footy as well. But next question, our guy, Daz Wilson. He doesn't go a week without throwing in the questions. We love it. And I like this question as well. This is on the Blues. I think he's a Carlton man. We're starting to sense a little bit of a trend here. But he asks, is Jack Martin now a top five player in this Blues outfit? Based on 2020, we have to go by yes or no.
Okay, let's have a think about who's there. So, Cripps, yes. Walsh, yes. I think you put him in that mix. Where do you put Liam Jones? Because we talk about these key defenders. Like, he is super strong down there. Doherty, is he in that mix? Probably. He's not far off it. I don't think I'd quite have him in the top five at this point. You've got to remember, of course, Charlie Curnow is not even here this season, so where would he fit into that mix also? Yeah, Casbolt's stepping it up. I don't necessarily think I'd have him in that group, but he's not far off it. Where's Mark Murphy fit? I think Martin's probably in the 5 to 10 range. How would you say it?
Yeah, he's in my 6 based on this season. I don't have Sam Walsh in there. I think he struggled a little bit. He's not using the ball well at all. So I haven't got Sam Walsh in there. I've got Cripps 1, Doherty 2, Wiedering 3 I've got. He's been fantastic. And 4, I've got the old boy. I've got the old fella, Cade Simpson. I think he still just sets them up so beautifully well. I think they lose a lot if he's not in the side. Again, talking about that guy that he's always took it on. I mean, he was kind of ahead of his time for that half-back role. Now, 5 and 6. I've got Jack Martin. You can slot him in at 5. You can slot him in at 6 if you want. But he's averaging 15 disposals, going at 78%. Mark's inside 50. He's number 1 at the team with 13. He's taken 5 contested marks, and he's kicked 8 goals. He's only behind Levi Casbolt and Eddie Betts, who have kicked 9. So I think in terms of Carlton needing Jack Martin to play well to win, I think he's in the top 5. The only other guy that I had close, it's our guy, Pitney. I don't know, whatever you want to call him. You know, he's leading the league in hitouts to advantage per game with 9.8. He's been fantastic.
Yeah, he's been a real fine. And that's a money ball pick. It's finding the undervalued guys and bringing them in. You know, no opportunity at Hawthorn, but we like what we see. Let's go back to what we've seen from him at VFL level. Let's go back to what we saw from him at under-18 level. The opportunity there, can he still do things? You know, teams get it wrong all the time. North Melbourne has always seemed to raid the Bulldogs players who aren't quite up to it. Nathan Hrovat, Tom Campbell, hey, they didn't have the opportunities. Turns out it's because they weren't that good. But you can find those players at other teams. And that's exactly the sort of approach there. Now, Daz had a couple other quick ones. He said, would you bother bringing Buddy Franklin back if the Swans keep losing? Probably not. But, you know, if Buddy wants to play, then maybe you throw him out there for a bit. I wouldn't be rushing it, though.
No, I mean, I don't think they are going to rush it, but I'm bringing him back. The Swans, listen, they're not going to win many games. I don't think bringing Buddy Franklin back into the team with how many guys have got out is all of a sudden going to turn the season and they're going to cost themselves draft picks or whatever. He's getting on. We don't know how many opportunities we're going to have to see Lance Franklin play again. I think if you're the Swans, you have to bring him back. He would be desperate to get back and play. So I think the answer is yes. Maybe if it was strictly business and you're like, listen, we want that number 2 pick. Maybe we can catch the Crows, get that number one pick, then maybe.
I don't think it's that. I think it's more like this is an old man who's had a serious hamstring injury. We know old guys can re-ping that pretty quickly or pretty significantly, and you want to eat into his preseason. So I'd have to be real sure that the hamstring is okay before putting him in, because that's to me the concern there. Not, hey, look, if you lose games and get a higher draft pick, then by all means. But I agree, he's not going to turn everything around. But it's
what
more
are you
the
waiting for?
If he was 25, okay, sure. But he's not. He's what, 33 at the moment, and coming off a severe hamstring injury. That's the worry I have. That how would you feel if he comes back in and plays round 16 at the second last game? Plays it, that's fine, and then the last round gets in and pings the hammy and then misses the next 6 to 8, and then the preseason's cut into.
It'd be unfortunate, but I mean, I don't know where the cutoff is in this 17-game season where you say, all right, it's too late for you to make that return. I'm not sure, but I don't know what you're waiting for. I don't think that Sydney next year, I mean, I'm not looking at their list and saying, yeah, this is a team that's going to catapult into premiership contention next year. So if he's right in the next 4 or 5 weeks, I think you're playing. But
if it's in that time, yeah. Look, but I'm talking about if there's 3-4 games to go and he's on the borderline, I'd say, okay, bud, let's just sit this out, mate. But if you can come back and play 10 games or 8 games, 7 games, then sure, you try it. You got to be safe with it. But if it's for the last couple, I wouldn't worry with it.
Last couple, we've got a quick one from the email at the end, a very quick one. But this one here, is Dangerfield the new favourite for the Brownlow? The easy answer is no, isn't it?
Yep, it's no. It's Lachie Neale is, I'm looking at the moment, got the odds up. He's 275, Cripps is 9, and Dangerfield is 10. So that's, you can argue as much as you want whether Cripps or Dangerfield or the next guys is Fife, Bontem, Pally and Grundy. Those guys are all close, but the massive difference between Neale and next group would say absolutely not.
Yeah, I've got right now, I went back last night and had a look. I've got Dangerfield picking up 2 against Hawthorn. I think he picked up 2 against Carlton in the loss where he had 21 possessions and 5 clearances. And I think he had 3 against Brisbane on Thursday night. So, I mean, he's on 7 votes and he's a vote getter. He's going to be around the mark. But still, yeah, I think Lachie Neale is the clear favourite. So last question here via the email. Daniel Setches asks, and first of all, I've got to read the first line because it's complimentary of the show, which is fantastic. He says, hey guys, absolutely loving the show. Great content, and you bounce opinions off each other so well. It's awesome to listen to. My question is, would you consider putting some time into an AFL Supercoach Fantasy podcast? We've had this a little bit. I love Josh's NBA podcast, and I would love a similar thing, even if it was a short, buy low, sell high segment. We've spoken about this a little bit. You are the fantasy NBA guru. I'm playing Supercoach, and the listeners will know if you've been listening right from the start, I haven't mentioned Supercoach for a couple of weeks. That's for very good reason, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
It's a great idea. The problem is I haven't played AFL fantasy in 10-plus years, so I wouldn't be coming from an area of expertise. Ideally, if this show grows enough, we want to expand out our Locked On AFL network here, and we would definitely be bringing something like that in. We might start with a few sort of DFS picks during the end of the week and see how that goes, but in terms of season-long fantasy stuff, I'm just not across it at this point to come out and say anything confidently with it. So I can assure you I won't be hosting anything like that, but we would look to get something like that on the podcast or network at some stage.
The mailbag. You know, last week I was a little bit concerned, Josh, that the questions dried up a little bit, but this week it was fantastic. So every single Wednesday, keep that in mind. I think we got to everyone's questions. If we didn't, make sure you hit us up on Twitter at LockedOnAFL or via email LockedOnAFL@gmail.com.
Guys, Kane, thank you for coming on with me again and talking about this, even without your character reference here. It's been fantastic to chat with you.
Cats and the Pies tomorrow night. Footy's back. It's going to be really wet. Another good game.
Guys, subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. And go and leave a 5-star review. If you love the show, go and leave that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show out fantastically. And I'm going to leave you today with a shout out to David Burke.